Oh, well, hey, everyone, it's Nate from The Vinyl Guide, and if you like this podcast, please consider becoming a show patron at patreon.com/vinylguide. Now, I do this show because I love records, I love music, and I love talking to interesting people, and I give it away because, well, that's just how podcasts work. So feel free to show your love for this show by sponsoring us for a few bucks each month, $5, $10, whatever you could spare there, at patreon.com/vinylguide. And thanks for your consideration. This week on the show, we are talking all about the early years of Mr. Bungle with their very first manager, the person who got them signed to Warner Brothers and whose phone number was on all those crazy and collectible cassette tape demos, Kristen Yee. Now, Kristen was involved in the Bungle camp from the very early days. The cassette tape demos, the negotiation with Warner Brothers, the early touring, the recording of the first album, through the recording of Disco Volante, and today she is going to share some stories and some extremely interesting perspective about the band and help fill in some of the gaps of information and put it out into the Bungle sphere. Now, Mr. Bungle has always been a band with its own lore. It's not easy to get new information about the band, especially from those early days. So, Bungle fans, make sure you are in your comfy chair, fresh drink in hand, because this one is for you. Also, as most Mr. Bungle fans will know, the last Bungle album, California, was released 20 years ago this month. In fact, I was at the very first show of that tour, the California tour, at this club called Palookaville in Santa Cruz, California. That was on July 12th, 1999. Now, why do I know this date? Because a listener to this show heard that I was at that show through some social media post or something and found my actual voice in the crowd on a bootleg of that show. How friggin' bizarre is that? I'm not going to play it here, but if you want to look it up, it's like at 36 minutes, and it's me having an exchange with Mike Patton about the movie Orgasmo from the crowd. That is very bizarre. Anyway, happy anniversary, Mr. Bungle, California. You still sound great 20 years later. Oh, and by the way, this episode is brought to you in part by our good friends at Voyage Air Guitar. If you play guitar or know someone who does, go to voyageairguitar.com and check out the unique design of the Voyage Air. It's built for travel and is really, really very innovative. No more snap necks from disgruntled baggage handlers. The Voyage Air neck snaps down and is designed for travel and built for quality. Head over to voyageairguitar.com and check it out. Voyage Air Guitar, the future is unfolding. And by the way, if you like Mr. Bungle and or this interview, there are several other episodes of The Vinyl Guide I'd recommend you check out as well. Episode 167 of The Vinyl Guide with Greg Workman of Ipecac Records. Greg was on the show talking about his time managing Mr. Bungle, the recording and touring of California, what was due to come after California, and even the possible future of Mr. Bungle, which got everyone all hot and bothered. So that's episode number 167 of The Vinyl Guide. Also today, Kristen and I talk briefly about her cousin Brain, who was drummer for many bands, including Primus and Guns N' Roses. And damn it, we had Brain on our show for a two-parter, episodes 133 and 134 of The Vinyl Guide. And finally, if you like the funk, and we all do, we had the godfather of funk himself, Mr. George Clinton, on The Vinyl Guide talking about his vinyl record history and telling some awesome stories. That's episode 61 of The Vinyl Guide. Now, all these and heaps more are available on our online apps over at Google or Apple Store, and they're all free. So become a show patron so I can keep eating and churning out these episodes at patreon.com/vinylguide. And with that, let's get into The Vinyl Guide interview with Kristen Yee, a.k.a. Jesus Christ, on the early years of Mr. Bungle. This week on The Vinyl Guide, we are entering the Bungle sphere with Kristen Yee, who is the manager of Mr. Bungle for a period of time. Kristen, how long were you the manager of Bungle? Kind of what eras?
From the era of when the guys started playing just local gigs down in San Francisco, because they were all based, up in Eureka. And so they came down to record that demo OU818. So it was kind of from that period, and then booking them local shows until I think it was the second album with Warner Brothers. So that was probably a duration of maybe 4 or 5 years.
All right. Well, that's the real juicy period. I mean, between OU818 and Disco Volante is a fascinating time period. So, how did you come to know and learn and meet Mr. Bungle?
Well, my cousin Brain, who's the drummer of the Limbo Maniacs, Primus, Guns N' Roses, that whole Bay Area thing. Of course, we grew up next door to each other. And when he was in the Limbo Maniacs, his bandmate Pete, who did composing for like commercials and things like that, he rented an office at this recording studio called Different Fur up in the Mission District. And they needed someone at the studio to help out, answer phones, be a gopher, that kind of thing. And I was like, oh, yeah, cool. I'll take that job, summer job, things like that. So I got into it by just hanging out at the recording studio, getting familiar with Brain and the Limbo Maniacs. And their manager, Dave, who was also the manager for Primus and a few other local bands, he was booking Bungle like a few gigs for them. And Dave asked if I could help him book some of the bands because he was booking so many bands. I was like, yeah, sure, no problem. So Bungle was one of those bands that I started booking for him. And we just kind of built this relationship. Patton and I really hit it off. We were just buds and got really close to the guys. So just kind of became their main person. And it all started from there, where the timing consequentially was when Faith No More, I think it was The Real Thing, that was the album that kind of put them on the map, right? Their multi-platinum album. That one was just starting to roll and become huge. So that's when the guys recorded OU818. And there was just like ideas of like, hey, let's shop this around. So it's like, okay, and just started doing some of that.
So at that time, Mike Patton is in two different bands. One of them is starting to go fantastically well. And then there was Bungle, which was like, his passion project, I guess you could say. When you entered the picture, was he already kind of in Faith No More, or was that a discussion that was about to happen? Where was that at?
He was well into Faith No More. The Real Thing had already come out. They were starting to book their first tours, which those guys, to propel them into the status they were in, they were on tour for like a good year, just playing everywhere and blowing up the whole scene. And during that time, I mean, I was lucky enough to go to like Saturday Night Live because Faith No More was the musical guest, go to the Bammies, all of that kind of stuff with him, just learning and observing the music business, and at the highest level at that point. So that's when he was like, well, let's just see what we can do with Bungle at this point. And because Faith No More was already becoming huge, at the peak of that whole album, that's when it was so simple for people to start sniffing around, going, well, what about Mr. Bungle? So it was pretty easy where labels were approaching me.
At the time, Bungle was it on hold while Mike was kind of doing his thing? Is that what the
That was always kind of the difficult thing, is Bungle, of course, was always on the back burner because, those were his high school buddies, that kind of thing, hometown friends, like you said, passion project. And Faith No More was his professional entity, that was huge. So it was one of those contemptuous relationships, I guess you could say, with Faith No More and their management at all times, where they're kind of like, yeah, that's cute and all, but that's your little, side project. Let's not get serious about
Don't
it.
spend too much time there. Oh, okay. I never even thought about the management of Faith No More, because I would think that there would be perhaps a bit of a some difficult conversations between the band members of Bungle who want to do something and their lead singer who's obviously got other priorities at the moment. But I didn't even think about the management of Faith No More. Just so they were rather dismissive and didn't want Mike to spend much time with Bungle.
They were like, just forget about that. That's cool, whatever. Let's focus on, Faith No More, which rightfully so, they should. But when it started getting a little serious about word getting out that other labels kind of wanted Bungle, then I started getting the call from Faith No More's management, Faith No More's label, like the president of their label, going, look, we need to fly up to San Francisco and have a meeting with you guys. And it's like, okay. So we all scheduled a meeting at my office. At this point, Primus's manager and myself were sharing an office. Mm-hmm. And I had quit the recording studio. I was kind of doing this full time now.
Right.
And those guys flew up, and it was kind of, you know, they were the heavies. And we're like, oh, geez, these men that are like more than twice our age are coming up to not intimidate us, but go, look, this is what's going on. You can maybe get a deal with Slash, you know, the Faith No More's label, going, you know, we'll kind of do this little favor for you type of thing. And Faith No More's manager was definitely like, yeah, I can manage Mr. Bungle. Maybe we'll make you like a road manager or something like that, you know, just to sort of humor me.
Give you a title.
Yeah. Yeah. Like, you know, whatever, little girl, just step aside. We got this. So we met with those guys. They flew up and, you know, they sort of presented themselves. They were super cool. It was no problem. But after the fact, after the meeting, you know, we all went out and got a burrito or something on the mission. And I was like, hey, you guys, if this means you guys can propel Bungle to another level, by all means, go for it. You know, I'm not going to get in the way. Do what you need to do. And the dudes were so loyal to me and super good. You know, we had just built this great relationship, friendship, really, that was turning into a business. So they're like, no, we want to stick with you. Let's do this together and try and check it out and stay its course. So that really meant a lot to me. That was really cool.
Yeah, because I guess if Slash had taken on Bungle, then they could have completely derailed it. They would have had a, you know, direct hands in being able to say, you know, the album wouldn't come out, it wouldn't compete. They could keep it locked away forever.
Exactly. And that was kind of the thing with Warner Brothers. Like, I can tell you how we ended up on Warner Brothers.
Sure.
It was one of those things where Interscope, all of these other labels were like totally chomping at the bit now. Like, hey, we want to give you a deal, that type of thing. Come down to LA, showcase for us, that whole thing. But Patton, being very respectful and very business savvy as well, was like, you know what? I don't want to disrespect my label, which was distributed by Warner Brothers Distribution. So he's kind of like, well, let's kind of keep it in the Warner Brothers family, which, you know, made sense at the time because we're like, yeah, we don't want to rock the boat. We don't want to disrespect your professional entity you've got going right now. The band members were already kind of, Faith No More's band members were not happy about any of this going on, of course.
Right.
And so, you know, Mike and the guys kind of made the professional decision, well, Warner Brothers has offered, you know, us a deal to be on Warner Brothers proper, you know, the Warner Brothers label. Mm-hmm. So that's how we sort of came into it. But the whole thing was, well, can you do it? Can you be signed to two different record labels, even though it's under the same distribution? So we got a pretty heavy entertainment attorney named Stan Diamond, which totally sounds like a movie name.
It's like the Cartoon Network kind of, hi, I'm Steve Diamond here.
Right, exactly.
Gleaming teeth.
So this guy, he was super heavy back then. Like, I think he represented Cher and Ozzy and like a lot of the big music people. So he, Mike gave him, you know, his contract with Faith No More to go, hey, is there any way, I don't want to get out of it, but is there any way that I can foresee doing Bungle on a separate project with another label? And so Stan combed through that contract for us, and he found the loophole, which wasn't really a loophole because I don't think labels sign acts with the intention of their artist doing something else professionally on
right.
a completely another label with another band. You know what I mean? Like, they might do a solo project or something. So he found it where collectively Faith No More was signed exclusively to Slash, but individually Patton wasn't signed if he was going to do another band. So that was kind of the loophole. And we're like, okay, well, if you're sure with it, then let's go. And it happened. So
just skipping around a bit, do you think that
that sort of dynamic that was set up between Patton and Slash and Patton and Warner Brothers. Do you think that played into the next Faith No More album, Angel Dust, being not really promoted very well? Do you think any of that carried over?
I don't know if it really did. I don't think so, because the personnel was so different. I know Faith No More had an independent marketing company, so they were pretty well geared up with resources. I think just because their next album was so different, maybe that's why, you know, it was just sort of came off a little differently. But I don't think there were any really politics or anything like that behind it.
Gotcha.
Yeah.
Okay. So you got involved with Bungle just prior to OU818. Is that when, were you familiar with them up to that point with all the different cassettes and the trading and that
scene? Yeah, like the Bowl of Chile, all of that kind of stuff. I had actually seen them come play, you know, for a few gigs that Dave had booked for them. And was getting familiar with them at that point, but not in the early on Eureka days where those guys were, you know, making their stuff
right
back up there. So it was about OU818. I think the time that I was booking them and when I actually started hanging out with them was when they were actually recording OU818 with David Bryson.
I guess the plan was for them to just keep doing these demo tapes and hopefully get signed. Was that kind of the strategy? Series of Hail Mary activities?
I think it was just a fun thing for these guys. I mean, these guys were so smart and accomplished on their own. They're just a bunch of nerds, you know, that have futures ahead of them other than music. So I think it was just like a fun passion thing for them, too. I don't know if they were actually, it was one of those things where they're like, we're going to try and do this professionally, make a career out of it. It's just when labels came sniffing around, they're like, oh, well, Maybe this can be a real thing.
Now, were they rowdy? Were they hard to control?
Oh, my God, Nate. These guys are like the same age as me at the time. I think even maybe a couple of them were older than me. But I had never babysat before. And this was like being thrown into the fire of like the extreme.
Like what are some examples of that?
I mean, I'm so surprised I never had to get bail bonds for one of these guys, seriously. But little funny things of just trying to rein all six of these guys in. I remember when we first signed with Warner Brothers, the Red Hot Chili Peppers had also just signed with Warner Brothers. So we, the label flew us down to Burbank, you know, to meet with each department to say, this is going to be your product manager, this is your publicist, this is, you know, your promotions team, that kind of thing. So we're going from meeting to meeting, and the Chili Peppers happened to be there that day too, doing the same thing. And I don't know if you know or everyone else, but, you know, the Chili Peppers and Patton always kind of had this not even love, hate thing going on, where Kiedis was always saying, Patton's such a ripoff of me, that type of thing.
Was
right?
that already in effect before they were?
Yep.
Okay.
Right. Yeah, yeah, there was already that going on. So we're going from meeting, they're going from medium, and there's kind of like a courtyard in between, you know, departments and offices. We catch sight of each other, and then everyone starts mouthing off, and it's like, oh, no. So it's getting heightened, and I'm going, this isn't good. And, I mean, Flea could, like, rip your head off. Like, what are you doing? Because these guys are, you know, a bunch of nerds on Bungle, and Kiedis and Flea were, like, getting closer and closer. The arguments are starting, the insults are, and it's just like, oh, no. And I was like, guys, we got to get to the next meeting, you know, and I'm trying to cut in front of them. And thankfully, their side was like, hey, we got to go into this video thing or something. So it's just close calls like that.
So it was face-to-face? They were, like, almost chest-to-chest telling each other?
Almost.
F you, F that?
It was like, yeah. Where I was like, oh, this is going to be so bad. Like a fight at Warner Brothers Records. That just can't happen. You know, and just dumb things like flooding the floor at the Phoenix Hotel in San Francisco. You know, just being funny, wise guys. Like leaving the bathwater on and then they end up flooding the whole floor and getting banned for life from the hotel. You know, and it's just things that you can't control that. Oh, my God, these guys. You know, and then in the beginning, it was like they were super destructive. Like, Patton would jump off the stage onto, like, a $5,000 velvet curtain at some theater And it's like, well, we got to pay for that. So, and I think as soon as those kind of things started having to be recouped out of the proceeds that we were receiving, then they started going, oh, okay, maybe we shouldn't bust stuff up because it actually comes out of our paycheck.
Nothing to make you responsible like a $5,000 bill.
Right? Exactly.
So how often did they play live shows at that point?
It was one of those intermittent spotty things where Faith No More was going full on. And anytime Mike had off, it was like, okay, let's book this tour. And so we were lucky enough to get a booking agency, ICM. Mm-hmm. And it was Troy Blakely. And Troy had also booked Faith No More. So he kind of knew the markets that, you know, were appealing, that whole thing. And it's so funny because Troy Blakely, may he rest in peace, he just passed away recently, but he was probably the only music business professional that took me under his wing and was super cool, was a mentor and just an amazing guy. So he would, you know, get on the horn, book these little mini tours, whether it be, you know, lucky enough to do a national tour, which we did get to do, or just something up and down the California coast, just always depending on Patton's timeline, right, you know, with Faith No More. So we were always kind of taking the back seat with that one.
I know the guys are known at this period always wearing masks and stuff on stage. Do you know where that generated from?
Yeah, it was one of those things, even with the deal with Warner Brothers, where the marketing department, promotions department, any kind of mention of Mike Patton in their marketing was absolutely not allowed. So even when they would book show, like Troy would book shows for us through ICM, part of the contracts for booking were like, there's not to be any radio advertisement, no posters, anything like that, mentioning Mike Patton of Faith No More, you know, with his band, Mr. Bungle, that kind of thing.
Right.
So these guys wanted to obviously establish themselves as Mr. Bungle, not Mike Patton's Mr. Bungle. So that's where they started wearing these masks. And like, Mike's like, I'm going to wear a mask. So people don't, I mean, they probably did know, but he didn't want to be Mike Patton, his face. So he started wearing bondage masks and all of that. And then the rest of the guys got into the whole thing, and it was just this clown show from there.
Was it a, you know, more of a contractual thing? Was it more of a goof? Or was it more of a, look, I want this band to be known on its own, not for this other thing I'm doing?
Totally, I want this band to be known on its own, okay, not for Mike Patton. And for a goof, too. I mean, if those guys enjoyed being idiots, let me tell you.
Okay, so they start bringing in the masks and all the mayhem. And I guess what's interesting about this period is trying to find some video, there doesn't seem to be a lot. There's the talent show that they did when they were like 14 or 15, Eureka High. Then there's the Warfield show. Is there much in between? Is there much other video available that you know of?
There isn't, unfortunately. And, you know, I mean, this is when the era before cell phones, camera phones, anything like that.
Sure.
And there's not a whole lot of footage. I mean, Warner Brothers gave us the budget to do a video for MTV, mm-hmm, which we hired Kevin Kerslake. We filmed the video for quote-unquote in the middle of the night, you know, up in areas in the San Francisco Bay Area. And already knowing when Kevin had storyboarded this thing out, it wasn't going to get aired. So we're like, well, I was like, why are we making this when it's never going to air? This is tens of thousands of dollars and it's all going to be recouped out of your royalties. You know, so it's one of those things where their artistic integrity, which I totally respected at all times, and that was just Bungle. And I was like, okay, well, we're going to roll with it that way. You guys are going to have a fun night. You're going to shoot this thing. And then it ends up, you know, on YouTube or something like that in the present day. But it never aired back then because MTV was like, oh, no, no, no. Bondage masks, people hanging, some guy, you know, chasing somebody with a knife, not happening. So.
Right. So
yeah,
with the recording of the self-titled album, there was a rumor story. I don't know if you can, I'm sure you can confirm. Frank Zappa was originally named to produce the album. Is that true?
No, I mean, he was definitely of interest to produce the album. We would, you know, we wanted him to, but he just wasn't available, or he didn't want to, or wasn't that familiar. So unfortunately, no, he was never slated to actually do so. He was sought after, but it never happened.
Okay. So the conversations didn't go very far at all. It was just a request for interest, request denied. That was it.
Yeah. Yeah. Which after the album came out, I got a phone call at my office from his wife saying, "This is Gail Zappa. Can you hold for Frank?" And I'm like, going, "Wait a minute. Wait, Gail Zappa, can you hold for Frank? Frank Zappa?" And he got on the phone and said it was an amazing album, and just to let the guys know that outstanding work. And I was like, wow. Well, you should have produced it then. But
holy shit. That is awesome.
Yeah, but that's probably the heaviest phone call I had ever gotten. I was like, wow.
It's like the president. Hold for the president.
Yeah. Can you hold for the president? I was like, yeah. Let me process this. Who am I talking to?
So in terms of recording the album, it seems pretty straightforward. These were songs that were on some of the original demo tapes, maybe a new one here or there. Anything eventful you recall about the recording of the self-titled album?
It was almost a well-produced, better-sounding version of OU818. Mm-hmm. You know, that's and they recorded it at different for the studio I used to work at, because I got them good rate. It was a really awesome studio. We got John Zorn to produce. You know, he was doing all the Naked City stuff. Mm-hmm. Guys were a huge fan, and he came in from New York to produce, which was awesome. And it was just hijinks, you know, trying to keep them under control, trying to keep them on budget, trying to get POs issued from Warner Brothers, and just keeping those guys on track, which for those guys, it actually went very smoothly for Bungle.
What did Zorn bring to the table? I mean, obviously he's got this cachet, he's got this experience, and the guys you know, loved his influence, but the songs, they seem to be already pretty well baked by the time they get to recording that album. What did John Zorn's presence change about that record?
I think he just brought such a sense of creativity and confidence with the guys, mm-hmm. you know, and he really knew what he was doing managing a studio session and, you know, kind of bringing his edgy sound, you know, and he played sax on the album as well, which was like insane that he was actually willing to do that too. Mm-hmm. But I just think his creative genius that these guys respected so well. And it really made it a fluid experience for them. Like, he was the best babysitter I could have asked for, because who knows how long or how it would have ended up. Because he was the ultimate professional.
So they were on their best behavior with him as well. That helped you scale.
Yeah, yeah. You know, because in the beginning, it's like, okay, well, let's get acquainted. This guy is on a pedestal. And then by the end of the album, it was like, okay, he's going to go out and play pinball with them or just do something stupid, you know, ride the freight train, that kind of thing. Uh-huh. So they kind of pulled him into their world, too.
Now, a lot of the samples of that first album were from video games and movies. Did you have to do the official clearances, I assume, or?
Yes. Thankfully, I didn't have to, but the Warner Brothers legal department hated me. Because I was like, okay, this reference is from, and I just had a laundry list of references that some of them were even obscure, even when it came down to the album cover art. They're like, this book that this picture is taken from was printed in 1942. Can you see if you can get the rights to use it? So the Warner Brothers legal team hated me.
Now, that book, that artwork, I think is from a book called A Candy Cane Autopsy. Now, how committed were they to having that? Were they, this is the cover and we accept nothing else? Is that what the mission was? Or were there other options available in case that one fell through?
No, that was it. And Bungle was very good at, this is the way it is, make it happen.
Right. Okay. Were there any samples that didn't get the clearances that would have been on the album had they had their way?
No, actually, everything happened to miraculously work out with a lot of legal help.
Just another in the long line of Bungle miracles there then. Well, actually, there is one thing here. Travolta. The song Travolta was renamed, quote unquote. Can you tell me the story about that?
Yeah, because obviously John Travolta. Mm-hmm. And Warner Brothers won that battle because they're like, nope, We don't need John Travolta to come back and sue us for using his name, which isn't like Jones or Smith. It's Travolta, you know? So they were like, nope, you have to rename it. So then those guys, they actually folded for once and said, okay, yeah, we'll just rename it. But yeah,
the first pressing of the CD actually says Travolta. So it was right. An after the fact conversation. Someone went, holy shit, put on the brakes.
Yep.
Okay.
Exactly.
All right.
One of those tired out people in the legal department, you know, woke up and went, wait a minute. How did this pass through?
Hang on. I have to earn my money this week.
Exactly. Because the first crew already quit from what we put them through. So like the new people came in and went, wait a minute.
And the title, quote, unquote, was that kind of based on the legal paperwork or why was it renamed to quote, unquote?
It's just one of those things that bungle, like maybe a band member just shouted that out and said, well, that's what it's going to be called. Same thing for like the publishing company, you know, for mechanical royalties, you have to have the publishing company. Mm-hmm. And we were all sitting around, they couldn't think of a name. And I think one of the sax players was like, ah, just beam me up, Lord. And Patton was like, what? Beat me up, Lord? And then that was the name of the publishing company from then on out.
Oh, God.
Beat me up, Lord Music.
Oh, God bless them. So the album comes out. Well, before the album comes out, what was Warner's response to the final product? Did they question it at all? Did they ask for something different? What was that conversation like?
They didn't ask for anything different. I mean, I think the footwork that I was doing leading up to the release, trying to work with the product managers and marketing, trying to work with the promotions team, going, look, this is going to be a college radio thing. This is, you know, trying to prepare them and steer them in the right direction as much as you could, being on this huge commercial label. They didn't ask for any changes, anything like that. It was just sort of like, what do we do with this? And it's one of those things, being such a tiny little obscure left field band, you know, they're like, what do we do with this? And trying to navigate through that was really tough. You know, and I actually moved down to Los Angeles to be closer to the label so I could be there to say, look, I need to get in a meeting with you, with our A&R guy, that kind of thing, to try and navigate this. But man, you get lost in the shuffle. It's a big machine.
When the album came out, how was the reception of the record? I mean, obviously the fans loved it. Was the label happy with the response?
Yeah, I think the label was pretty happy and maybe even surprised, you know, because I think they ended up selling a couple hundred thousand albums or so, okay, you know, over the time. But I think a lot of it was just they were hoping it would be propelled off of Faith No More's popularity, fans knowing who Faith No More was and that whole thing, even though we were trying to get into, you know, the CMJ, college markets, things like that, independent alternative areas. But I think overall, you know, it did okay. And the label, I don't know, it was just, I think it was too huge. So
Bungle getting lost in the shuffle, I guess. Yeah.
Yeah. I mean, they had the Chili Peppers and Madonna to deal with.
When Bungle recorded that album, did they have any outtakes, any songs that didn't make, I mean, did they do a studio version of Mr. Nice Guy or Thunderball or different things that just didn't make the album, or pretty much what you see on the album is what they recorded?
It was pretty much, yeah, what you see on the album is what they recorded, just because of the timeline and the budget.
So obviously, Patton still has this other career of Faith No More. After the self-titled comes out, was the band able to properly do a promotion cycle on it with some proper shows, a proper tour? Or
We actually did a couple of showcases. I remember we went to New York. I think it was for CMJ or New Music Seminar, one of those conventions, just to kind of get it out there into the industry as well. And they actually got to do a national tour, which was awesome. But they did happen to miss quite a few radio interviews, magazine interviews that I was like, oh, God, you guys, because this was before cell phones. So my road manager would only have a pager, and the publicist at the label was like, they didn't answer or they didn't call in for this radio interview and all of that. And I'm trying to page my road manager, and then they'll call me 2 hours later saying, oh, well, we got sidetracked because there was this cool cemetery and everyone wanted to check it out. And I'm like, oh, my God. So they didn't care much about self-promoting. You know, they were all just having fun.
Right. Okay. And so after the self-titled album comes out, it's received quite well. Mike's got his other job he's got to do. There's a bit of a lull between self-titled and Disco Volante. What was happening during that period with the band?
Yeah, that's when Faith No More was still full steam ahead. And then a lot of the guys in Bungle, you know, they're just kind of still trying to live their lives. Like one of the sax players got accepted to Cornell University as, you know, a physics major, and people were just, you know, waiting. We're all in a waiting pattern. And even myself, I was taking other bands to manage. Warner's had, you know, thrown me a few bands, newer bands, like, hey, you want to manage these guys? We were all just sort of twiddling our thumbs waiting for the Faith No More machine to, you know, have a little hiatus. Mm-hmm. So we were always kind of in that backseat area. Mm-hmm. Understandably.
And so Trey and the guys, they started writing music for what became Disco Volante, doing demos.
Yeah.
Did the band practice a lot without Mike, or were they kind of in their individual corners just making music on their own?
They were kind of in their individual corners, unfortunately. Mm-hmm. Yeah, that was a hard thing. It was just always trying to rally these guys together, you know, and it's like you can't force creativity, right? You can't say, hey, we're all getting it together in the studio. You're going to sit down and you're going to, you know, create this. It just didn't happen like that, so.
Right, and how was the temperament of the band? Because they're at home in California writing music and surviving off what Bungle provided. But here's Mike Patton on television, on MTV.
Right.
How did the band reconcile with that?
There was definitely a lot of frustration, you know, on everybody's part, understandably so. But it's just one of those things that was out of our control. Mm-hmm. You know, it's just this huge waiting game constantly. Mm-hmm. So I don't know if that could have had any kind of effect on hampering, you know, their creativity or the progress of their writing or anything like that. But I mean, that's personal to them. I don't know what was going through their heads individually. Mm-hmm. You know, I was just down in LA trying to do my thing.
Right.
So.
Well, I would imagine there would be some frustration. And then, of course, when Mike gets back off tour, he probably needs a bit of a break as well. And here's five other guys like, come on, let's go with this other project. Do you recall any of the conversations or the dynamics around that?
I mean, definitely Mike, you know, he was exhausting himself playing Rock in Rio and just doing world tours, promotions, things like that, and a very well-oiled machine. So when he came home, it was just, with Bungle, it was like, oh, well, these are my buds. This is my family. Mm-hmm. And then I think they would sort of start a slow burn towards creating additional songs. And, okay, well, let's collaborate. Well, so-and-so's not available. Well, you know, so it's just with six guys, it's definitely hard. And then I think one of the sax players was already in New York at that time attending Cornell. And, you know.
Sure. Life goes on.
Yeah.
So Disco Volante, it just holds this very prestigious, depending how you look at it. I call it prestigious. Other people may say confusing or use whatever words, confronting space in the field of modern music. It really is unlike anything that I was exposed to, at least at the time anyway. And I imagine it was certainly different from what many Bungle fans were expecting. What was the reaction of Warner Brothers when that album was turned in?
That was a complete question mark for them and even for the fans. Like, wait, what is this now? Because this is so different. And a lot of the Bungle fans had been underground OU818 fans. So they were already familiar with the songs, you know what I mean? Mm-hmm. But with Disco Volante, it was totally new. Like, wait, we need to try and get used to this. Is this good? Is it different? Is it, you know? So that was a tough one. And Warner Brothers had just a huge question mark, like, what the hell do we do with this? We were already confused with the first album. Now we're like, what?
And I imagine there were conversations about there's nothing here we could play on the radio. There's nothing to be able to promote, but yet the album went forward anyway, which I think is just incredibly delightful. tell me about that journey from when it was handed in for when it was out. There must have been some hilarious conversations in between.
Yeah. I mean, I remember sitting across the desk from Mo Austin, who was the president at the time, and he was an old man at that time. And I was this kid, and he's looking at me like, what's going on? So we picked up your second option for the second album, and, you know, you turned in this. What are we going to do with it? And, you know, it was a tough conversation. It was definitely confusing for them, even in the independent marketing realm. Mm-hmm. It's like, how do we promote this? What do we do with this? You know, and the guys were like, hey, this is our creation. What are we going to do? When are we going to go on tour? You know, that kind of thing, where it was still fun for them. Mm-hmm. But when it comes to business, you know, it's serious. It's a serious industry. And if your label doesn't know what to do with you, that's scary.
Yeah.
And so a lot of times when I try and explain, you know, like, well, they're kind of having trouble. We can't get this on the radio. And our time is always sort of limited. What are we going to do with this? You know, and it was discouraging at points.
Because you had to defend it. And you had to actually be in the middle of both of those conversations. I mean,
yeah. Yeah, where the guys were standing their ground, which they should. That's their art. But then I'm going to a very commercial, huge label, being the in-between, going, okay, so with this song, are we, you know, are we doing any videos? They're like, no, we just spent tens of thousands of dollars last round to, like, not have it air. We're not doing that again. So it was, I think they were more hesitant towards letting us do stuff or promoting it in certain ways because they just didn't know what to do.
Yeah. Now, obviously, the label would have wanted something that could be marketed because that's what they do. Were there ever any points that the album almost didn't come out, or were there points that the album was almost, you know, chopped up or changed in any way?
No, because it was, they picked up the second option. So at that point, the label is obligated to give you the funds to record it and release it. And that's kind of all they did. Yeah.
Okay. And was it recorded in different fur as well?
No, it was actually recorded down in Los Angeles. I can't remember the name of the studio. It was down in Silver Lake near where I was living. So the guys were staying with me. We flew down our engineer from San Francisco, and they recorded it all in this little studio in L.A. So it was a totally different vibe, totally, you know, different scenario from, like, sort of the home, comfortable, we're still kind of goofing off a bunch of kids into, all right, well, we got pressure now to make this thing, and we're still going to stand by our art, which, you know, I would always back them up at any given time. That's who they are. So
right. And
it was a different vibe.
Were they in good spirits, or was it a frustrating period for them?
I would say from my standpoint, observing, it was more of a work environment. Not so much the fun and games anymore. It was just like, okay, we got it. We got to, you know, get this thing recorded and present it and get it released. Right. So, yeah.
And what are your memories around the artwork of the album?
Oh, God. Well, I know it wasn't super tough this go around with all the legalities and clearances, things like that. So, from my end, a lot easier.
Okay. All right. Because they had artists. They're working with artists directly on the imagery and the pictures
exactly.
And things like that. Okay.
Right. So it's not like some obscure photo from, you know, some print or something like that Warner's had to research. So,
but I mean, the band name isn't even on the album cover. You know, was that another set of conversations with Warner Brothers?
And at that point, I don't even know if Warner's even wanted conversations. You know what I mean? They're like, well, these guys, we obviously know they're going to do what they're going to do anyway. So, just give it to us.
Right.
You know, they were kind of, I think, in that mindset now. Yeah.
And what are your thoughts about Disco Volante?
I mean, I loved it. You know, I was a huge Bungle fan in every faction of everything they created. You know, and obviously I got to be there throughout, you know, the whole creative process and the recording and things like that. So, I mean, I stood by it and I tried to defend it as much as I could to the label, but you know, like I said, it's tough.
Mm-hmm. The opening track, Everyone I Went to High School With Is Dead, it seems to be the most strategically placed opening track that I'm aware of, because if you could make it through that, you have this glorious album ahead of you. But that is it is such a barrier to so many people. Is it was that one of the reasons why they put it up front, or am I just imagining things?
You know what? I don't know, but that sounds pretty plausible that could have been a strategic move. I never heard the conversation, but it could have been like, okay, are you ready for the endurance test? Try this.
Yeah. This'll weed people out.
Yeah, exactly.
And how was the reception of the album when it came out? Was it as Warner thought? Was it as the band thought? I mean, obviously they were happy and proud of the finished work, the band was anyway, but did it sell enough to where Warner's was okay with it?
I don't think it quite performed what they thought, not putting a lot of marketing and promotions into it. You know, I think they were still just confident that the whole Faith No More train and the little obscure Mr. Bungle fans were just going to carry its weight into having the album perform how it should, you know, up to its potential. But yeah, I don't think they were that impressed with it as well. But I mean, to their own detriment, it's right. Like, help us out here. You know, you've got all this money to help us out and all these resources. Let's do it. But so
is there a theme to Disco Volante?
Theme. That's a good way to put it. I don't know if there's so much of a theme or a feel to it, but I think where the guys were creatively and just dynamically as a group, as a band, it's kind of reflective. Mm-hmm. You know, a lot different. I don't know.
Yeah, because the first album, I always think the theme is around a dark circus. California, I mean, obviously
yeah.
California, it's almost right. a Twisted Beach Boys. But Disco Volante is always like, okay, but maybe there's something here, maybe there's not. Just
Yeah. I don't think it was very theme oriented. It was just like, okay, can you take this? See if you can handle it. You know.
Endurance test, as you said.
Yeah.
Now, the first vinyl pressings of Disco Volante included a 7-inch from Secret Chiefs. What was the conversation around that like?
That was definitely something that's, you know, a whole Patton orchestrated thing. And I didn't really have anything to do with the Secret Chiefs or anything like that. So I think that's where he was sort of starting to exercise a lot of his creative control. Mm-hmm. So that was very cool. You know, it was something that I didn't orchestrate or make happen in any sense of the word. Mm-hmm. So, yeah.
Okay. Because Secret Chiefs is more of Trey's thing. Yeah.
Yeah.
Perhaps I always read that as an attempt for Trey to and the band to start having another platform outside of Mike.
Yeah, I think everyone was always in a holding pattern. So everyone else was getting kind of itchy to do their own thing, sort of explore their own creative avenues. Trevor, the bass player, you know, was doing a lot of stuff with Zorn, mm-hmm. A lot of his performances. And everyone was just like, well, let's see what we can do, mm-hmm. you know, on our own, too. So.
And how much of a tour did they do for Disco Volante?
Oh, gosh. So spotty. It was really spotty. Yeah. I mean, the first album is where we got to do the most touring. And then the second album was just really spotty as far as performances and all of that. And it was just sort of becoming a disaster with relationships, with the guys like being in separate areas, separate mindsets, kind of trying to see what they could do creatively on their own. So as a collective unit, you know, it felt like it was dispersing a bit and mm-hmm. not as tight.
And this is where it sounds like you parted ways with the band.
Yeah, I had moved down to LA and I was just like, I can't be in this holding pattern myself, you know, and I got into sports marketing. So I was doing this job at, you know, this sports company. And then it was just like, this is too much to deal with. And then Patton said, hey, can my friend Greg help us out? He's up here with us. And I was like, please, you know, by all means, just take it and run, because I don't know what I can do with it anymore.
Okay, so you passed the baton on to Greg. Were they already starting to put together California at that point, or was that?
I don't think they were. I don't even know if the third option was in effect at that point.
Right. Okay.
Yeah.
All right. And when you think about Bungle and the legend of Bungle, and and what are your thoughts in terms of the fanaticism around that? I mean, there are people who just absolutely adore this band to the point to where they're collecting masks. They're looking for there's these t-shirt collectors that are looking for every single tour t-shirt there is, any sort of artifact from that time.
Right?
How do you respond?
It's crazy. I mean, I always run into Bungle fans. It's so funny because when I started working at that sports marketing company I told you about, one of the painters at that company had Mr. Bungle's original CD artwork up at his painting station. And I was in my office and he came in and he knew even the personnel listed on the CD cover. He goes, "Are you the same Kristen Yee that's listed on this, you know, as the manager of this band? It's my favorite band." I was like, "Yeah." He's like, "What are you doing here now?" And he literally almost started crying. And then it's just like you run into the craziest scenarios. But these people are diehard, like you said. They want to collect everything. And I was in Alaska on vacation a couple of years ago, and I went on this white water rafting thing. And the guide was like this metalhead dude. And, you know, you just make conversation with your guide. And he's all, "Yeah, I'm from the San Francisco Bay Area. And I love, you know, Faith No More and Mr. Bungle and Primus." And I go, "Dude, you're not going to believe this, but I used to manage Mr. Bungle." And it was insane things that you run into. The fanatics are out there.
Do you have any of those sort of artifacts from the day? Anything interesting you're holding in the Kristen Yee archives?
Yeah. I mean, I think I still have, you know, all the t-shirts we printed. I have the red vinyl of the Mr. Bungle, the first album. They did a printing of red vinyl. So I've got that. That's just insane.
I did not know that.
Yeah. And then still, you know, the little marketing promotion things of the stickers, the postcards, those kind of things. But the thing that I wish I would have done was documented more of our journey. You know, at that time, I think I had, what is it? Not Super 8, but Mini 8, you know, those little video cameras.
Yeah.
And I recorded some of the studio stuff, you know, at different fur. I recorded some stuff on tour, but just not enough because I was working, you know, like trying to settle up promoters, things like that. And I just wish it was the era of like cell phone video recording and things like that. I wish I would have documented so much of that stuff because it was just hilarious, you know, and just some of the hijinks and memories of Patton, you know, doing a Roger Daltrey, spinning the mic on the cord and clocking some kid in the front row in the head, splitting his head open. And I was like, "Oh boy, here's a lawsuit." And the kid was like so excited that Mike Patton split his head open.
Well,
so if maybe
it's good cell cameras didn't exist then. Let's put it that way.
That's true, right? The evidence.
I remember stage diving has gotten to a very safe place these days now that everything's documented, you know, so.
Right. Yeah. Yeah. And that's true.
So
that's a good point.
So Kristen, you know, and that record, that LP, that red vinyl one, I'd love to have pictures of that if you're able to, because I don't think that's documented anywhere. I'm looking at all the different collectibles.
Seriously?
That must be super rare.
I'll get that for you.
Yeah. I'll make sure that's shared in the, not just the Bungle sphere, but also Discogs and record collector circles. Cause that sounds like a very rare one.
Yeah, it is. So I'll dig that up and take photos for you.
Please. Anything else around Bungle that I haven't asked that you think is important for the Bungle fans to know?
Gosh, it was just at that time we were all a bunch of kids not knowing what we were doing, thrown into this fire of making something that was fun into trying to make it into something that was professional. And it is what it is, so.
Mm-hmm. Oh, well, God bless you guys, because I think Mr. Bungle just holds that place to where it's a, they did it their way, and they did it on someone else's budget.
Absolutely, right?
Did you ever get a chance to meet Stub?
Yes!
Yeah?
Oh, my God. Stub-a-dub, yes.
You know,
Stub was awesome. He was covered in tumors when I met him.
Oh no. Okay.
So I know.
How long did he live for? Do you remember?
You know what? I don't know how old he was, Nate, when he passed.
Yeah.
But when I met him, he was already up there. So.
Okay. And that was Trey's dog, I believe.
Yep. Yep, Trey's dog.
That is, look, you know, I don't get too emotional over songs, but there are a couple of Mr. Bungle songs that really have impacted me emotionally. Stub-a-Dub is one of them. As crazy
and
insane as that song is, I think it perfectly captures the spirit of a dog and the irreverence of, you know, dogs just doing dog things. And, of course, our human attachment to them. And whenever I introduce anyone to Mr. Bungle, that's generally the entry point.
Oh, that's so cool. Yeah. And it's so true, too. Yeah.
Yeah. Well, God bless Stub. God bless you. God bless Mr. Bungle. Kristen, thank you so much for coming on the show.
Oh, thanks a lot, Nate.
Oh, that was fun. The early days of Mr. Bungle with Kristen Yee, a.k.a. Yeezus Christ. Thank you so much for coming on the show. By the way, Kristen and I did speak after the interview. She was trying to find that red vinyl. That may have been a false memory. Kristen did manage many bands after Mr. Bungle, so that red vinyl she mentioned was likely one of them, not of the Mr. Bungle debut. However, she did share some pictures of Mr. Bungle that I don't think have been shared before. Haven't really been made public, so I've included those in the episode art as well. You can enjoy them over at thevinylguide.com. Alrighty, well, that's it for this week's episode of The Vinyl Guide. I sure hope you enjoyed it. And if you did, well, you could always show me some love. Patreon.com/vinylguide. Give us a sponsorship of $5, $10, whatever you can each month. It sure helps us churn out these episodes and keep the show going. We'll be back next week with a brand new episode. So until we talk next time, keep spinning. Cheers.
That's it for this episode of The Vinyl Guide. Send your thoughts to Nate at thevinylguide.com or follow or tag us on Instagram at @vinylguide. Until next time, keep spinning.